The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to Hogen Sensei and those of you at the temple, and Hogen Sensei and all the online practitioners. We have students in New Zealand who, some stalwart members may be listening to it right now in the middle of the night, but I know their intention was to watch this later at a time to meet their schedule, and students and Sangha members all around. Thank you for being here this morning. So Ango, peaceful dwelling, is an authentic custom within the house of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And as many of you know, in the time of the Buddha, during the rainy seasons every year, when it was very difficult to travel, Sangha was actually not allowed to travel. It was not safe. And this was before monasteries had been built. And so they would gather and practice intensively, study the Dharma. And so that cyclical tradition continued even when monasteries had been built, and has continued all through the ages and takes its form in different schools in different ways. Within our tradition, it is Ango. As I was listening to the Eno read out the name, two by two, being called in into this ark, this vessel, this ship that is launching to cross over, this image in Mahayana Buddhism of crossing over to the other shore, the shore of enlightenment. And so we begin this journey, this particular journey today, with Ango at the beginning of the whispers of spring. Spring is not here yet. Actually, in the fascicle by Master Dogen on the practice period, one of his fascicles in the Shobogenzo, he tells a story of the Buddha who told Ananda that he was going into a three-month retreat because his disciples were not really paying attention when he gave discourse. And that if anyone should ask where he was, that Ananda should just provide them with an answer. So this is a tradition, and we part of that authentic custom is that we try to, having evolved it, and we have, and certainly have adapted it to our time, including encompassing the lay sangha, that it isn't strictly for a cloistered community, as it was traditionally, and in other ways, still try to retain and respect and honor the aspects of the tradition in terms of how we begin, as we began this morning, and how we conduct the Ango. I was reading in that fascicle by Master Dogen this morning, and he was giving instructions about how all of the students, which were, again, remember, were all monastics and would have come from different parts of the countryside to a particular monastery to study with a particular teacher. And then after Ango would go off to their home temples or would just travel elsewhere. And he was talking about that list that was read and how that would be put together. And he said some monastics who had previously trained in small monasteries, including those who had been abbots of small temples, might be invited to serve in different positions, head monastic, secretary, administrator, and so on. He said, since it's not unusual for people to make fun of positions in minor monasteries or temples, such monastics may prefer their past positions not to be acknowledged. I thought that was a curious thing to insert. And then he said, the following is an example of such a list, such as we just read out, and I've adapted it to, because he presented it as to be adapted to wherever it might be read. So, in the Way of Reality Monastery on Heavenly Light Mountain in Ulster County, New York, United States, the names in the Ocean Assembly forming the spring practice period are as follows. So our wording is a little bit different. And so we customarily have a theme for each Ango, something that focuses our attention, something that is always part of our practice, part of the teachings, but now we bring it out and sort of bring it into highlight so that we can really study it, examine it, gain understanding, sort of place it at the center of our practice. And so this Ango's theme is trust in Buddha nature. And we'll be using primarily the Lotus Sutra to as the sacred text that we'll be engaging in. But we'll also be studying, mostly in the Ango intensive, another small Mahayana Sutra called the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, which is the womb of the Buddha, womb of the Tathagata. And Tathagata is a name for the Buddha. It means either one who has thus come or one who has thus gone, referring to the Buddha. One who comes thus, one who goes thus. One who in appearing appears unborn. One who in passing or in going appears as undying. And Tathagatagarbha, garbha means womb. And so this is a term that in Mahayana Buddhism came to be understood as Buddha nature, the womb of the Buddha. That is, that within each of us, we all possess this Buddha nature. And that very wonderful image of the womb, which is brings in very decidedly the feminine, this place of our birth, this place in which we are brought into being in conception. We can might think of this as raising bodhicitta, that we are nourished over those many months in our actual birth and over the course of our lifetime as practitioners. And in that womb, we are receiving everything that we need. And it is a refuge. It is a place in which we are protected and held. And at the same time, it is a place from which we need to come forth. And that coming forth is not always easy. And so Tathagatagarbha, one scholar I was reading said that this notion of Tathagatagarbha seeks to answer the question of why and how is it that deluded people can awaken. If a person is deluded, then how can they come to enlightenment? How can they possess what is needed in order to come to enlightenment if they are deluded? And so this Buddha nature can be thought of in a kind of a passive sense, that it's just this potential that exists within each of us that we bring into fruition, bring to realization through our practice. It can also be understood in a more active way, that it is like a force, like an energy, like a something that has a living quality to it within us that is seeking to be brought forth, that raises bodhicitta, that brings us back to our vows. Buddha nature can also be misunderstood as something that exists, something that somewhere is locatable within us as though it's a thing. And so that is, it is not that. In a sense, it is an idea, but it is an idea that is connected to something that is real and is experienced, not in an inherent, intrinsic way, but in something that is inherent within or that is an essential part of the spiritual path, certainly within Buddhism. And the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, which we'll be studying, is very short, it's only a few pages, is thought to be the earliest expression of Buddha nature. In fact, it may be where the term Buddha nature actually was first seen in the literature. And so what I want to do is read just a little bit from the beginning of that sutra, near the beginning, to give you a sense of it and also to bring out this theme at the beginning of the Anga. At that time, the Buddha sat up straight in meditation in the sandalwood pavilion and with his enlightened powers put on a miraculous display. So this is a very much a Mahayana sutra. And so as is true for so many of these sutras, it's entering into a world, right, that is miraculous, that is vast and boundless, that defies our ordinary logic. Burton Watson, actually, in his translation, in his introduction, he said that one of the functions of this is to dislodge us from this tether we have to everything that must be measurable and comparable and touchable, right? This kind of, this binding that we have to, that the only thing that exists is what we can see and measure. And so it's the sort of the grandeur, the impossibility of these worlds that the Mahayana Sutras create is such to free us, begin to free us of that. And so using his enlightened powers, the Buddha put on a miraculous display. There appeared in the sky a countless number of thousand-petaled lotus flowers, as large as chariot wheels, filled with colors and fragrances that one could not begin to enumerate. In the center of each flower was a conjured image of a Buddha. The flowers rose and covered the heavens like a jeweled banner, each flower giving forth countless rays of light. The petals all simultaneously unfolded their splendor, and then, through the Buddha's miraculous powers, all withered in an instant. Within the flowers, all the Buddha images sat cross-legged in the lotus posture, and each issued forth countless hundreds of thousands of rays of light. The adornment of the spot at that time was so extraordinary that the whole assembly rejoiced and danced ecstatically. In fact, it was so very strange and extraordinary that all began to wonder why all these countless wonderful flowers should suddenly be destroyed. As they withered and darkened, the smell they gave off was foul and loathsome. But at that point, the world-honored one realized why the bodhisattvas were perplexed. And so he addressed Vajramati, one of the bodhisattvas, saying, "O good friend, if there is anything in the Buddha's teaching that perplexes you, feel free to ask." Bodhisattva Vajramati knew that everyone in the whole assembly was perplexed, and so addressed the Buddha. "Never, ever have I witnessed a miraculous display like today's. To see hundreds of thousands and millions of Buddhas seated in the calyxes of lotus flowers, each emitting countless streams of light, filling all the fields, scattering the dirt of false teachers, adorning all the worlds. The lotuses suddenly wilted. There was not one which was not disgusting." "Now tell us, why did you display this conjured vision? We see Buddhas more numerous than the sands of the Ganges." At that time, the world honored one spoke to Vajramati and the other bodhisattvas, saying, "Good people, there is a great essence called the Tathagatagarbha. It was because I wanted to expound it to you that I showed you these signs. Listen attentively and reflect on it well." And everyone said, "Excellent. Yes, we very much wish to hear it." And the Buddha said, "Good people, there is a comparison that can be drawn between these countless flowers conjured up by the Buddha that suddenly withered and the innumerable conjured Buddha images with their many adornments, seated in the lotus position within these flowers, who cast forth light so exceedingly rare that there was no one in the assembly who did not show reverence. In a similar fashion, good people, when I regard all beings with my enlightened eye, I see that hidden within the kleshas, all of the negative karmic afflictions that we all carry, the afflictions of greed and anger and desire and delusion, within all of these there is seated augustly and unmovingly the Tathagata's wisdom, the Tathagata's vision, and the Tathagata's body. good people, all beings, though they find themselves with all sorts of kleshas, have a Tathagatagarbha that is eternally unsullied and that is replete with virtues, no different from my own. Moreover, it is just like a person with enlightened vision who can see the bodies of Tathagata seated in the lotus position inside these flowers, even though the petals are not yet unfurled. Whereas after the wilted petals have been removed, those Tathagatas are manifested for all to see. In similar fashion, the Buddha can really see the Tathagatagarbhas of sentient beings. And because he wants to disclose the Tathagatagarbha to them, he expounds the sutras and the Dharma in order to dissolve the kleshas and reveal the Buddha nature. And so these flowers that the Buddha has conjured, we can think of as all of the beautiful, lovely, wonderful, distracting things, the pleasures, the things that we strive after, that we work so hard to attain, and then mourn when we lose them because everything is impermanent. And so then we seek after them again. But they keep wilting. No matter how beautiful they are, they wilt. Right? We can't preserve them. We can't hold them. But what the Buddha is saying is that within, once those are allowed to wilt, finally, what we see is a Buddha seated on the Bodhi seat, where they've been all along. And that the Buddha is able to see this. This Buddha seated augustly and unmovingly, possessing the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's vision, and the Buddha's body, who has all of the virtues, no different from the Buddha's own. And that it's because the Buddha sees this within each of us, as every enlightened teacher has seen it, that the Buddha and all of the bodhisattvas want deeply for us to see that. That is becomes the whole purpose of their lives. The driving force, the great yearning, desire, their unending vow. And so, beginning this Sangha, we enter into our Dharma practice that is replete with not only all of these enlightened virtues, but also our karmic impulses, our histories, our reactivity, our mental and emotional habits, all of the cycles that keep us bound, keep that Buddha sitting unmovingly, hidden from us. And although that Buddha, in fact, is not hidden, has never been hidden, it has not yet fully been revealed to us. And that's why having faith in Buddha nature is so important. Because how do we have faith in something before we have directly experienced it? And when the evidence of our lives and the lives around us seem to point to another reality, how can I have possess in full all of those enlightened virtues when I don't live those enlightened virtues, when I keep falling into greed, anger, delusion, when I'm so susceptible to all of the hooks upon which I get caught? Where are those enlightened virtues in such moments? Where is that enlightened vision? And so having faith in Buddha nature, right, which every single practitioner already has, by virtue of your being here. You may argue against that, but I think that's a waste of time and precious energy, and that the evidence belies your argument. Watch what you're doing. See the evidence. You're sitting on this seat. You have brought yourself here, and you keep returning. I spoke the other day, yesterday, in fact, I believe, and just acknowledged that we are practitioners and invited us to really just reflect on and appreciate what does that mean? Because it's a word that we use so much that we can I mean, that's what happens, right? We hear words over and over like Buddha nature, and we stop examining and reflecting and appreciating the power of what these, not just what they mean, but what they're pointing to. And in that, they lose their power. And I said that to be a practitioner means that we don't just read the Dharma, we don't just listen to talks, we don't just do meditation, but that we engage actively. I spoke this morning about how practices are really the translation of a teaching into an embodied living thing. In a sense, a teaching that rests on a page, or in a sense, even that is giving, is not live yet. It may be for the speaker, but it's not live yet for the person who's receiving it until they take it in and it comes to life within. That's why we're sitting on these seats. That's why we're in this training hall. That's why we come together. That's why it is a path. It is something that we do. It means that we directly transform those teachings into our bloodstream. It's like a transfusion. It fills, becomes our vital energy. It becomes our mental and emotional energies. In a sense, in a very real sense, we are taking all of those things that bind us in samsara, like our thoughts and our mental images and the meaning of words and our physical body, which can, in a misguided way, cause all kinds of trouble and distress. And we learn how to use those same elements. We use words and the meaning within words to give rise to a vow, to bring forth an intention for this day, for this ango. We bring forth the mind's capacity to form a mental image and create a visualization. Or when we do the four immeasurables, we hold the people of Ukraine, for instance, in our mind, and the people of Russia, and President Putin, and everyone who is at the receiving end of aggression and violence, and even everyone who is at the giving end of aggression and violence, and wish for them in the deepest way that they know the roots, both of their aggression, but also of their happiness, which they ultimately seek. And so we're using that capacity of the mind to bring forth that image, that scene, those faces, that sense, that felt sense of those people. To be a practitioner means we are committing ourselves to living this. And those beginning or those, you know, we do this at whatever point along the way we are. So we might be doing it in a very beginning way. We might be doing it in a very not yet sure way. Not yet sure this is my path. Not yet sure what all this fuss is about. We might be doing it in a way in which do know that this is our path, but have not yet fully committed ourselves to it. We may be doing it in a way that we are fully committed and we have a life that is very demanding and makes it difficult to give as much time as we might like to the more traditional forms of practice. We might be a monastic who have dedicated our whole lives to doing this. So this works wherever you are. And so there is daily practice where we establish and tend to that ground, the image of the garden, which is so much used in Buddhism, tending to it every day, making sure there's sufficient light and water, that those weeds, those things that would obstruct, that would distract, are tended to. And that we move forth from that cushion every day, and back again, and then moving forth into our life and back again, until that sense of movement, of division, of boundary between the cushion and off the cushion begins to blur. And we do seshin, where we take that established, tended to ground, and we extend it, we expand it, we explode it. We begin to see how large it is. we begin to see the limits that we create in our mind in our daily practice so that they can be expanded and exploded. And we do Ango, where we basically do all of this together for 3 months. And so during the Ango, there is the daily practice, there is the sessions. We met on Thursday night, had a Sangha meeting, and went through a lot of the detail of what will be, how we will practice during the Ango. We'll be doing mandos every other week, basically, during the mando, on the Lotus Sutra, which is one of the most really important, wonderful teachings and sutras of Mahayana Buddhism. Dogen, as I've said earlier, was very, seemed to love the Lotus Sutra. He drew on it a lot in his teachings, referred to it a lot. Hakuin, an important teacher in the Zen tradition, had a very formative kind of a profound experience with the Lotus Sutra very early on in his life that helped to establish his path. It's had incredible influence on many schools of Mahayana Buddhism and actually helped some schools to come into creation. And one of the reasons I've been wanting to focus on it for a while, as I mentioned, we studied it in the city years ago when I was in Brooklyn, but that was for just the city sangha for the most part. But, you know, months ago when I was imagining this day, and I thought, okay, where are we going to be in March? Like, what's going to be going on? Where's COVID? What's going on in the world? Where are our minds and hearts going to be? What will we need? What will be the medicine? And of course, I didn't know. But I thought, there are going to be challenges. And I thought of the Lotus Sutra, and in hoping to be coming out of COVID and the pandemic and being, you know, quarantined and all that we've been through the last 2 years and plus. And I thought of the stories of the Lotus Sutra, of the parables and what good stories are. And I thought, everybody loves a story, right? Let's tell some stories. Really, I thought of that. And I thought the Lotus Sutra and those stories are so powerful, and so it's so easy to enter in to those stories and those parables, and to just as this part of the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, and just find ourselves and be both uplifted and challenged. And so the essential part of Ango is all the ways in which we will come together through sessions, and as we begin opening up in the Ango intensive. There'll be a group of students receiving Jikai during the Ango, and essentially also everyday practice. And so every day to really establish what is your Ango practice going to be. And it is an intensive. And so there is that quality of intensification, of increasing our practice. Because the simple fact is, as human beings, when we bring more attention to, which is both in attention and also time, you can be completely present on your cushion for 5 minutes, and you are completely present. And you can be completely present in the same way for 30 minutes or an hour or successive periods and be completely present. And those are both the same and different. There is something that happens with time where doors open, bottoms fall out. Veils drop that comes in sustained effort over time. And so that is a part of it. And so working that out for those who practice at home and with all of your responsibilities is just part of working out your particular Ango. But I also really wanted to encourage, because of the time that we're in, just as we do every morning, do a service, and we dedicate that service to the Buddha, to our teachers, to our ancestors, to the Sangha, to the earth, and also in particular to those who are suffering. So I want to encourage everybody, whether you do a formal service, whether you just light a stick of incense, or whether you just hold this in your mind as you're sitting on your cushion, that you bring to mind people in this world who are suffering, people that are close to you, people that you will never meet. As you do the four measurables, you might do that within the context of ascending and receiving practice, or you might just do it by bringing it to mind. Those people, those faces, that group of people, that country, and that you extend to them your heartfelt wish that you be free of suffering, that you be safe, that you have the rightful opportunity to a life of happiness, that you see all beings from equanimity, which means with impartiality. You see all beings from within their Buddha nature, which is sometimes the greatest challenge of all. But that as you do that, it transforms your mind. It opens your heart. It develops your compassion. And it is also something that each of us can give every day. And if each of us is doing that together as a Sangha, and that we are doing that with people we don't even know who are doing that every day, and people in other faith traditions, and I'm sure people who don't even have a faith tradition, then that power becomes large. It is something we can do. It's not enough. It's not everything. Right? That's what happens with the dualistic mind. It's like, sure, I could do that, but it's not fixing the problem. No, it's not. If we stop thinking of it that way, either or, success or failure, it frees us so much into the power that we actually have. The sessions during Angha will be led, because we don't have a chief disciple for this Angha, and there are various reasons. COVID played into that somewhat, because it made it much harder to plan for a chief disciple who might be able to do this, because we didn't know what the circumstances were going to be. And so one thing that, in speaking with the teachers, Hogan and Hojin Senseis, was that each of them will lead an Angha, the session. So Hogan Sensei will lead the March session, Hojin Sensei will lead the April session, I'll lead the May session. And so they will sort of take that on, which will be kind of nice. Not kind of nice, it'll be nice. and give talks and begin and end the session. I also wanted to just mention Rebecca Lee's retreat. Rebecca Lee's a Dharma successor in Master Sheng Yen's lineage. She's a wonderful teacher. She's been here. She's a friend, someone who I hold in high regard as a Dharma teacher, as a human being. And I feel that we're honored to have her return and teach. She's going to teach on the Platform Sutra, which is also another important sutra. So I really want to encourage folks to come out for that. The Angha intensive will be, what I'd like to do is really concentrate on that one very important parable in the Lotus Sutra, which is sometimes referred to as the prodigal child, because it echoes, has similarities to the prodigal son parable in the Bible. And it's so powerful, there's so much to it, that I thought it'd be nice to really use that to kind of weave the Angha intensive, the Angha intensive, within the study of Buddha nature and the Tathagatagarbha sutra. So we'll be covering as much as we can of the Lotus Sutra throughout the Angha, but we're not going to be examining every chapter and every page. We just won't have enough time. So I'll be basically drawing on selections, and then really focusing on that one particular parable in that intensive. So in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, the Buddha said, seated within each of these flowers, augustly and unmovingly. And august is such a wonderful word. I remember years ago, we had named every session except the August session. And when we asked people for names, all they could come up with was hot, sweatbox, They were all kind of along that theme. But I remembered actually Fusho said, what about August session? And I thought, yeah, it didn't take. It didn't actually take. But I appreciated that because it sort of brought that word into my vocabulary. It was like, oh, yeah, what a wonderful word, August. To sit in the dignity of the Buddha posture, right? As the Buddha says, sitting up straight, the Buddha then began to teach. And to really appreciate, you know, as physical beings and this tradition which has so deeply, it's a yogic tradition, right? So deeply looked at the non-duality of body and mind and energy and spirit and heart and all. And so to really understand that your body is a mudra, that the way you hold your body has actually very profound consequence. And to appreciate and respect and you know, that this posture has come down to us through a lot of study and deep understanding. And it is very awake, right? And it is sitting forward. It is courageous. It is willing to face forward, and that all of the senses are opened. It is not retreating, but it is inward, and there's a difference. And it is very much present, but it is not proud, and there's a difference. And to manifest that in your body, and as each of us knows, it ain't so easy, right? It's not actually so easy to take this posture. And I don't mean just the flexibility of your legs, but to actually sit in this posture and be calm and relaxed. We realize that actually is a study unto itself that is cannot be divided from our meditation. And as the Buddha made clear, cannot actually even be divided from your life. What you do in your life shows up in this august posture. It's all one thing. I thought of Shantideva, who said, for I am like a blind person who has found a precious gem within a wilted flower. And it's as though by some strange chance, the enlightened mind, Buddha Bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment, has come to me. And so this is such a time to trust in Buddha nature, to be this one who is seated augustly, practicing our kleshas. August means dignified, distinguished, esteemed, exalted, noble, awe-inspiring. I remember an inmate many years ago wrote me when Buddhism was just coming into the prisons, and he was seated in this posture in his prison cell, and a guard walked by and started harassing him. I think he said he even wrote him up for an infraction. I don't know what that could have been, but it was like he was so, it seems, intimidated. August and unmoving in the sense of not turning away. And at the same time, within all of those qualities, it's nothing special. I thought of my old high school football coach who would say, now don't y'all go getting the big head after we'd won a game. Don't be thinking you're something special. So being august, don't get the big head. Let go of that self. Dogen, in his fascicle on the three treasures, I believe it was from there, said, I want you to leave the expedient means of the past to the past so that you can return to reality here, now. When you return to reality, it is not a name. Know that all things are rare treasures that belong to you. Receive and make use of them. Let go of the things of the past, even if they were helpful, and return to this moment. If you return to that expedient means in this moment because it's helpful, it's not in the past. It's a living thing. And know that all things, everything, is a rare treasure that belongs to you, not to be possessed, but to be received and made use of, to bring out its light. Somebody sent me a poem, a student sent me a poem along with a message during the week by Gwendolyn Brooks, who was an African-American poet, received the first, as an African-American, received the first Pulitzer Prize as an African-American. And she, I was listening to an interview with her, and the interviewer, who was white, asked her if, as a Pulitzer Prize, the first African-American woman receiving this, felt a responsibility to her Black community. And I thought that was a moment of what we call self-white centering, because, you know, if he was interviewing Mary Oliver, I feel pretty sure he wouldn't have said, "Do you feel a responsibility to your white community?" Right? Because being in the dominant white group, white people tend not to think of ourselves as a community. We're just people. And so we think of ourselves as individuals, where white people tend to think of people of color, Black and brown bodies, as belonging to groups, and so they become representatives. And she said, "I have never felt that an obligation or responsibility was put upon me by anyone else, and I am not a representative of anyone else." But she said, she said, "But I do feel responsible, as anyone with decency would. I don't feel responsible in the way that you suggest, but I do feel responsible as anyone with decency would feel." And that really stayed with me. Very simple. Of course, she realized she was responsible. Of course, we have a responsibility as decent people, as people. We have a responsibility to be responsible. We have a responsibility to serve. As practitioners, we take on the responsibility to practice and to take responsibility for our minds and for the karma that we create. And that responsibility, which in the beginning can seem sometimes burdensome, but more and more becomes a gift. Thank goodness I have the opportunity to give. Thank goodness I can serve. Thank goodness that I can have influence. Now, how will I use that? Having received that treasure, how will I make use of it? Because time is fleeting and impermanent, those flowers do wilt. Even the flowers of our practice, everything we create, every mind state, every state of meditation, every experience of samadhi, all the experience, all that we, the affect, you might say, that comes with insight, that is not the insight itself, is not realization itself, but is part of the transformation in our life. All of those are impermanent. Every good deed comes and goes. And so we remember impermanence. We, in a sense, have a responsibility to know that nothing lasts. When we don't know that, we're in trouble. We begin to be in trouble quickly. And so again, I think of Shantideva, the wanton lord of death. He said, "We can't predict. And life's tasks done or still to be done, we cannot stay, we cannot control. And whether ill or well, we cannot trust our lives, our fleeting, momentary lives." In other words, death doesn't wait until we've taken care of all of our responsibilities, until we've said everything we needed to say, until we've resolved every conflict, until we've forgiven everyone we need to forgive, until we've atoned for everything we should atone for. It doesn't wait for that. My enemies will cease to be, my friends, and I myself will cease to be everything that I see and touch and love and cherish will pass away. And that's just the basic nature of things. It's not a morbid, sad thought in Buddhism. It's a real thing. It's just a real thing. The beauty of the flower is that it's so beautiful. And the fact that it doesn't last is just its nature. It's not a betrayal. It's not disappointing us. And so we have this moment, these 3 months, an infinite of moments, infinity of moments, to receive this treasure that has been given to us and to use it well. Realizing that somehow miraculously, even though I'm like a blind person, right? Going along in my life, creating all kinds of mischief, falling into my cycles over and over again, wondering why. But wanting, yearning for something. And then, as though it, by chance, as though by miracle, or not even realizing how miraculous it was in the moment, just encountering the Dharma and thinking, oh, that's kind of cool. That kind of makes sense. And maybe that's all it will ever be. Or maybe it will be the beginning of the most profound transformation of your life that you could have never imagined. As I have said often, you know, being here, certainly being on the seat, that was never part of my plan. I had a plan. It wasn't this. So nobody knows where it's going. But somehow, as if by some strange chance, the enlightened mind, bodhicitta, seeking, has come to birth in us. And so to have faith, what is that anyway? Right? Was it just a decision you made? Encountering the Dharma, oh, I think I will have an affinity with this. No, that's not the way it works. Something happens, something miraculous. The Buddha said, the Dogen said, it's kind of like an inner conversion. Is that our Buddha nature, actually, that is moving, that is in subtle ways asserting itself? That when that Buddha nature comes into contact with the Dharma, it's like there's resonance. Like it comes into our consciousness in that moment. I don't know, actually. I don't know how it works. But I like that it works. And as we practice and become more and more attuned to that, because you have to, I said earlier about how easy it is to get lost, to stay on this path, you have to examine and develop facility within the subtleties of Buddha nature. To stay on the path and to make it strong. And so we don't have to know how it works, but we do need to learn how to speak its language and how to understand its language and to trust. Shantideva said, it is the universal vehicle that saves all wandering beings from the states of loss. That rising moon of the enlightened mind, I love that image. That rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrow born of the afflictions. Living beings, he says, calling out, wayfarers upon life's path, who wish to taste the riches of your own contentment. Here before you is the supreme bliss. Here, O ceaseless wanderers, is your fulfillment. And so, within the sight of all protectors, Shantideva says, I summon every being calling to Buddhahood, calling us in. And so let us practice together this ocean gathering. Let us create this peaceful dwelling. Let us bring through our own simple, sincere, ongoing efforts, the affirmation of all that is good within us, which is the same as trusting your Buddha nature, and to be generous with that when we might hold that back. Let us not be discouraged by the forces within us and around us that would cause us to be discouraged, to lose heart. Let us allow our hearts to become large and porous and resilient and trusting. And so I'd like to end with a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks. Speech to the young, speech to the progress towards. Say to them, say to the down keepers, the sun slappers, the self soilers, the harmony hushers, even if you are not ready for day, it cannot always be night. You will be right, for that is the hard home run. Live not for the battles won, live not for the end of the song, live in thee along. Live in thee along. That's now. And so to all those and to ours, those parts of ourselves that would say we are not ready for the day, very well, but it cannot always be night. And so we work on behalf of the day. And so that we might realize that the day and night are not in conflict, not one bit. That's the hard home run. And so off we go. And so please stay close. Let's stay close together in practice. And we hope that we see many of you during the Ango as things open up a bit, and in the temple as things open there. When we have faith in Buddha nature, that's just another way of saying having faith in human nature, in people. Despite how we act, despite how dark and deluded we can be, and we can be profoundly deluded and cause unimaginable harm. But that's always been true. Perhaps it will always be true. And what has been true all along the way is those who work on behalf of the day. And so let us join all of those, not just Buddhist practitioners, but all of those who are working around the world on behalf of peace, who love peace. And the Buddha realized if we truly want to bring that forward, we have to be peace. And so, peaceful dwelling.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.